Discourse 8 on the Love of Money by Thomas Chalmers. Job 31:24-28. If I have made gold my hope, or have said to the fine gold, Thou art my confidence, if I rejoiced because my wealth was great and because mine hand had gotten much, if I beheld the sun when it shined, or the moon walking in brightness, and my heart hath been secretly enticed, or my mouth hath kissed my hand, this also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the God that is above. What is worthy of remark in this passage is that a certain affection, only known among the votaries of paganism, should be classed under the same character and have the same condemnation with an affection not only known but allowed, nay cherished, into habitual supremacy all over Christendom. How universal is it among those who are in pursuit of wealth to make gold their hope, and among those who are in possession of wealth to make fine gold their confidence? Yet we are here told that this is virtually as complete a renunciation of God as to practice some of the worst charms of idolatry. And it might perhaps serve to unsettle the vanity of those who, unsuspicious of the disease that is in their hearts, are wholly given over to this world, and wholly without alarm in their anticipations of another. Could we convince them that the most reigning and resistless desire by which they are actuated stamps the same perversity on them in the sight of God as he who sees to be in those who are worshippers of the sun in the firmament, or are offering incense to the moon as the queen of heaven? We recoil from an idolater as from one who labors under a great moral derangement in suffering his regards to be carried away from the true God to an idol. But is it not just the same derangement on the part of man that he should love any created good, and in the enjoyment of it lose sight of the Creator? That he should delight himself with the use and the possession of a gift, and be unaffected by the circumstance of its having been put into his hands by a giver? That, thoroughly absorbed with the present and the sensible gratification, there should be no room left for the movements of duty or regard to the being who furnished him with the materials and endowed him with the organs of every gratification. That he should thus lavish all his desires on the surrounding materialism and fetch from it all his delights, while the thought of him who formed it is habitually absent from his heart. That in the play of those attractions that subsist between him and the various objects in the neighborhood of his person, there should be the same want of reference to God as there is in the play of those attractions which subsist between a piece of unconscious matter and the other matter that is around it. That all the influences which operate upon the human will should emanate from so many various points in the mechanism of what is formed, but that no practical or ascendant influence should come down upon it from the presiding and the preserving deity. Why, if such be man, he could not be otherwise, though there were no deity. The part he sustains in the world is the very same that it would have been had the world sprung into being of itself, or, without an originating mind, had maintained its being from eternity. He just puts forth the evolutions of his own nature as one of the component individuals in a vast independent system of nature, made up of many parts and many individuals. In hungering for what is agreeable to his senses, or recoiling from what is bitter or unsuitable to them, he does so without thinking of God, or borrowing any impulse to his own will from anything he knows or believes to be the will of God. Religion has just as little to do with those daily movements of his which are voluntary as it has to do with the growth of his body, which is involuntary, or as it has to do, in other words, with the progress and the phenomena of vegetation. With a mind that ought to know God, and a conscience that ought to award to him the supreme jurisdiction, he lives as effectually without him, as if he had no mind and no conscience. And, bating a few transient visitations of thought, and a few regularities of outward and mechanical observation, do we behold man running, and willing, and preparing, and enjoying, just as if there was no other portion than the creature, just as if the world and its visible elements formed the all with which he had to do. I wish to impress upon you the distinction that there is between the love of money and the love of what money purchases. Either of these affections may equally displace God from the heart. But there is a malignity and an inveteracy of atheism in the former which does not belong to the latter, and in virtue of which it may be seen that the love of money is, indeed, the root of all evil. When we indulge the love of that which is purchased by money, the materials of gratification and the organs of gratification are present with each other, just as in the enjoyments of the inferior animals, and just as in all the simple and immediate enjoyments of man, such as the tasting of food or the smelling of a flower. There is an adaptation of the senses to certain external objects, and there is a pleasure arising out of that adaptation, and it is a pleasure which may be felt by man, along with a right and a full infusion of godliness. The primitive Christians, for example, ate their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God. But in the case of every unconverted man, the pleasure has no such accompaniment. He carries in his heart no recognition of that hand, by the opening of which it is that the means and the materials of enjoyment are placed within his reach. The matter of the enjoyment is all with which he is conversant. The author of the enjoyment is unheeded. The avidity with which he rushes onward to any of the direct gratifications of nature bears a resemblance to the avidity with which one of the lower creation rushes to its food, or to its water, or to the open field, where it gambols in all the wantonness of freedom and finds a high-breathed joy in the very strength and velocity of its movements. And the atheism of the former, who has a mind for the sense and knowledge of his Creator, is often as entire as the atheism of the latter, who has it not. Man, who ought to look to the primary cause of all his blessings, because he is capable of seeing thus far, is often as blind to God, in the midst of enjoyment, as the animal who is not capable of seeing him. He can trace the stream to its fountain, but still he drinks of the stream with as much greediness of pleasure and as little recognition of its source as the animal beneath him. In other words, his atheism, while tasting the bounties of providence, is just as complete as is the atheism of the inferior animals. But theirs proceeds from the incapacity of knowing God. His proceeds from his not liking to retain God in his knowledge. He may come under the power of godliness if he would, but he chooses rather that the power of sensuality should lord it over him, and his whole man is engrossed with the objects of sensuality. But a man differs from an animal in being something more than a sensitive being. He is also a reflective being. He has the power of thought, and inference, and anticipation, to signalize him above the beasts of the field, or of the forest. And yet will it be found, in the case of every natural man, that the exercise of those powers, so far from having carried him nearer, has only widened his departure from God, and given a more deliberate and willful character to his atheism, than if he had been without them altogether. In virtue of the powers of mind which belong to him, he can carry his thoughts beyond the present desires and the present gratification. He can calculate on the visitations of future desire, and on the means of its gratification. He can not only follow out the impulse of hunger that is now upon him, he can look onwards to the successive and recurring impulses of hunger which await him, and he can devise expedients for relieving it. Out of that great stream of supply, which comes direct from heaven to earth, for the sustenance of all its living generations, he can draw off and appropriate a separate rill of conveyance, and direct it into a reservoir for himself. He can enlarge the capacity, or he can strengthen the embankments of this reservoir. By doing the one, he augments his proportion of this common tide of wealth which circulates through the world, and by doing the other, he augments his security for holding it in perpetual possession. The animal who drinks out of the stream thinks not whence it issues, but man thinks of the reservoir which yields to him his portion of it, and he looks no further. He thinks not that to fill it, there must be a great and original fountain, out of which there issueth a mighty flood of abundance for the purpose of distribution among all the tribes and families of the world. He stops short at the secondary and artificial fabric which he himself hath formed, and out of which, as from a spring, he draws his own peculiar enjoyments, and never thinks either of his own peculiar supply fluctuating with the variations of the primary spring, or of connecting these variations with the will of the great but unseen director of all things. It is true that if this main and originating fountain be at any time less copious in its emission, he will have less to draw from it to his own reservoir, and in that very proportion will his share of the bounties of providence be reduced. But still it is to the well or receptacle of his own striking out that he looks as his main security for the relief of nature's wants and the abundant supply of nature's enjoyments. It is upon his own work that he depends in this matter, and not on the work or the will of him who is the author of nature, who giveth rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, and filleth every heart with food and gladness. And thus it is that the reason of man and the retrospective power of man still fail to carry him by an ascending process to the first cause. He stops at the instrumental cause, which by his own wisdom and his own power he has put into operation. In a word, the man's understanding is overrun with atheism as well as his desires. The intellectual, as well as the sensitive part of his constitution, seems to be infected with it. When, like the instinct of an unreflecting animal, he engages in the act of direct enjoyment, he is like it too in its atheism. When he rises above the animal, and in the exercise of his higher and larger faculties, he engages in the act of providing for enjoyment, he still carries his atheism along with him. A sum of money is, in all its functions, equivalent to such a reservoir. Take 1 year with another, and the annual consumption of the world cannot exceed the annual produce which issues from the storehouse of him who is the great and the bountiful provider of all its families. The money that is in any man's possession represents the share which he can appropriate to himself of this produce. If it be a large sum, it is like a capacious reservoir on the bank of the river of abundance. If it be laid out on firm and stable securities, still it is like a firmly embanked reservoir. The man who toils to increase his money. He is like a man who toils to enlarge the capacity of his reservoir. The man who suspects a flaw in his securities, or who apprehends, in the report of failures and fluctuations, that his money is all to flow away from him, is like a man who apprehends a flaw in the embankments of his reservoir. Meanwhile, in all the care that is thus expended, either on the money or on the magazine, the originating source out of which there is imparted to the one all its real worth, or there is imparted to the other all its real fullness, is scarcely ever thought of. Let God turn the earth into a barren desert, and the money ceases to be convertible to any purpose of enjoyment. Or let him lock up that magazine of great and general supply, out of which he showers abundance among our habitations, and all the subordinate magazines formed beside the wonted stream of liberality would remain empty. But all this is forgotten by the vast majority of our unthoughtful and unreflecting species. The patience of God is still unexhausted, and the seasons still roll in kindly succession over the heads of an ungrateful generation. And that period when the machinery of our present system shall stop and be taken to pieces has not yet arrived. And that spirit, who will not always strive with the children of men, is still prolonging his experiment on the powers and the perversities of our moral nature, and still suspending the edict of dissolution by which this earth and these heavens are at length to pass away, so that the sun still shines upon us, and the clouds still drop upon us, and the earth still puts forth the bloom and the beauty of its luxuriance, and all the ministers of heaven's liberality still walk their annual round and scatter plenty over the face of an alienated world. And the whole of nature continues as smiling in promise and as sure in fulfillment as in the days of our forefathers. And out of her large and universal granary is there, in every returning year, as rich a conveyance of aliment as before, to the populous family in whose behalf it is opened. But it is the business of many among that population, each to erect his own separate granary, and to replenish it out of the general store, and to feed himself and his dependents out of it. And he is right in so doing, but he is not right in looking to his own peculiar receptacle, as if it were the first and the emanating fountain of all his enjoyments. He is not right in thus idolizing the work of his own hands, awarding no glory and no confidence to him in whose hands is the key of that great storehouse, out of which every lesser storehouse of man derives its fullness. He is not right in laboring after the money which purchaseth all things, to avert the earnestness of his regards from the being who provides all things. He is not right in thus building his security on that which is subordinate, unheeding and unmindful of him who is supreme. It is not right that silver and gold, though unshaped into statuary, should still be doing in this enlightened land what the images of paganism once did. It is not right that they should thus supplant the deference which is owing to the God and the governor of all things, or that each man amongst us should, in the secret homage of trust and satisfaction which he renders to his bills and his deposits and his deeds of property and possession, endow these various articles with the same moral ascendancy over his heart as the household gods of antiquity had over the idolaters of antiquity, making them as effectually usurp the place of the divinity and dethrone the one monarch of heaven and earth from that preeminence of trust and of affection that belongs to him. He who makes a god of his pleasure renders to this idol the homage of his senses. He who makes a god of his wealth renders to this idol the homage of his mind. And he, therefore, of the two is the more hopeless and determined idolater. The former is goaded on to his idolatry by the power of appetite. The latter cultivates his with willful and deliberate perseverance, consecrates his very highest powers to its service, embarks in it not with the heart of passion, but with the coolness of steady and calculating principle, fully gives up his reason and his time, and all the faculties of his understanding as well as all the desires of his heart, to the great object of a fortune in this world, makes the acquirement of gain the settled aim, and the prosecution of that aim the settled habit of his existence. Sits the whole day long at the post of his ardent and unremitting devotions, and as he labors at the desk of his counting-house, has his soul just as effectually seduced from the living God to an object distinct from him and contrary to him, as if the ledger over which he was bending was a book of mystical characters, written in honor of some golden idol placed before him, and with a view to render this idol propitious to himself and to his family. Baal and Moloch were not more substantially the gods of rebellious Israel than Mammon is the god of all his affections. To the fortune he has reared, or is rearing, for himself and his descendants, he ascribes all the power and all the independence of a divinity. With the wealth he has gotten by his own hands, does he feel himself as independent of God as the pagan does, who, happy in the fancied protection of an image made with his own hand, suffers no disturbance to his quiet from any thought of the real but the unknown deity. His confidence is in his treasure and not in God. It is there that he places all his safety and all his sufficiency. It is not on the Supreme Being, conceived in the light of a real and a personal agent, that he places his dependence. It is on a mute and material statue of his own erection. It is wealth which stands to him in the place of God, to which he awards the credit of all his enjoyments, which he looks to as the emanating fountain of all his present sufficiency, from which he gathers his fondest expectations of all the bright and fancy blessedness that is yet before him, on which he rests as the firmest and stablest foundation of all that the heart can wish or the eye can long after, both for himself and for his children. It matters not to him that all his enjoyment comes from a primary fountain, and that his wealth is only an intermediate reservoir. It matters not to him that if God were to set a seal upon the door of the upper storehouse in heaven, or to blast and to burn up all the fruitfulness of earth, he would reduce to the worthlessness of dross all the silver and the gold that abound in it. Still, the gold and the silver are his gods. His own fountain is between him and the fountain of original supply. His wealth is between him and God. Its various lodging places, whether in the bank or in the place of registration or in the depository of wills and title deeds, these are the sanctuaries of his secret worship. These are the high places of his adoration. And never did devout Israelite look with more intentness towards Mount Zion, and with his face towards Jerusalem, than he does to his wealth, as to the mountain and stronghold of his security. Nor could the Supreme be more effectually deposed from the homage of trust and gratitude than he actually is, though his wealth were recalled from its various investments, and turned into one mass of gold, and cast into a piece of molten statuary, and enshrined on a pedestal around which all his household might assemble and make it the object of their family devotions, and plied every hour of every day with all the fooleries of a senseless and degrading paganism. It is thus that God may keep up the charge of idolatry against us, even after all its images have been overthrown. It is thus that dissuasives from idolatry are still addressed in the New Testament to the pupils of a new and better dispensation. That little children are warned against idols, and all of us are warned to flee from covetousness, which is idolatry. To look no further than to fortune as the dispenser of all the enjoyments which money can purchase is to make that fortune stand in the place of God. It is to make sense shut out faith, and to rob the King eternal and invisible of that supremacy to which all the blessings of human existence and all the varieties of human condition ought in every instance and in every particular to be referred. But as we have already remarked, the love of money is one affection, and the love of what is purchased by money is another. It was at first, we have no doubt, loved for the sake of the good things which it enabled its possessor to acquire. But whether, as the result of associations in the mind so rapid as to escape the notice of our own consciousness, or as the fruit of an infection running by sympathy among all men busily engaged in the prosecution of wealth, as the supreme good of their being, certain it is that money, originally pursued for the sake of other things, comes at length to be prized for its own sake. And perhaps there is no one circumstance which serves more to liken the love of money to the most irrational of the heathen idolatries than that it at length passes into the love of money for itself and acquires a most enduring power over the human affections, separately, altogether from the power of purchase and of command which belongs to it, over the proper and original objects of human desire. The first thing which set man a-going in the pursuit of wealth was that, through it, as an intervening medium, he found his way to other enjoyments. And it proves him, as we have observed, capable of a higher reach of anticipation than the beasts of the field or the fowls of the air, that he is thus able to calculate and to foresee and to build up a provision for the wants of futurity. But mark how soon this boasted distinction of his faculties is overthrown, and how near to each other lie the dignity and the debasement of the human understanding. If it evinced a loftier mind in man than in the inferior animals, that he invented money, and by the acquisition of it can both secure abundance for himself and transmit this abundance to the future generations of his family, what have we to offer in vindication of this intellectual eminence when we witness how soon it is that the pursuit of wealth ceases to be rational? How, instead of being prosecuted as an instrument, either for the purchase of ease or the purchase of enjoyment, both the ease and enjoyment of a whole life are rendered up as sacrifices at its shrine? How, from being sought after as a minister of gratification to the appetites of nature, it at length brings nature into bondage and robs her of all her ample delights and pours the infusion of wormwood into the currency of her feelings, making that man sad who ought to be cheerful, and that man who ought to rejoice in his present abundance, filling him either with the cares of an ambition which never will be satisfied, or with the apprehensions of a distress which, in all its pictured and exaggerated evils, will never be realized. And it is wonderful, it is passing wonderful, that wealth, which drives all that is true and sterling in its worth from its subserviency to other advantages, should, apart from all thought about this subserviency, be made the object of such fervent and fatiguing devotion. Insomuch that never did Indian devotee inflict upon himself a severer agony at the footstool of his paganism than those devotees of wealth who, for its acquirement as their ultimate object, will forego all the uses for which alone it is valuable, will give up all that is genuine or tranquil in the pleasures of life, and will pierce themselves through with many sorrows, and will undergo all the fiercer tortures of the mind, and, instead of employing what they have to smooth their passage through the world, will, upon the hazardous sea of adventure, turn the whole of this passage into a storm, thus exalting wealth from a servant unto a lord, who in return for the homage that he obtains from his worshippers, exercises them, like Rehoboam his subjects of old, not with whips, but with scorpions, with consuming anxiety, with never sated desire, with brooding apprehension, and its frequent and ever flitting specters, and the endless jealousies of competition with men as intently devoted and as emulous of a high place in the temple of their common idolatry as themselves. And without going to the higher exhibitions of this propensity, in all its rage and in all its restlessness, we have only to mark its workings on the walk of even and everyday citizenship. And there see how, in the hearts even of its most commonplace votaries, wealth is followed after for its own sake. How, unassociated with all for which reason pronounces it to be of estimation, but in virtue of some mysterious and undefinable charm, operating not on any principle of the judgment, but on the utter perversity of judgment, money has come to be of higher account than all that is purchased by money, and has attained a rank coordinate with that which our Savior assigns to the life and to the body of man, in being reckoned more than meat and more than raiment, thus making that which is subordinate to be primary, and that which is primary subordinate, transferring, by a kind of fascination, the affections away from wealth in use to wealth in idle and unemployed possession, insomuch that the most welcome intelligence you could give to the proprietor of many a snug deposit in some place of secure and progressive accumulation would be that he should never require any part either of it or of its accumulation back again for the purpose of expenditure, and that, to the end of his life, every new year should witness another unimpaired addition to the bulk of the aggrandizement of his idol. And it would just heighten his enjoyment, could he be told, with prophetic certainty, that this process of undisturbed augmentation would go on with his children's children to the last age of the world, that the economy of each succeeding race of descendants would leave the sum with its interest untouched, and the place of its sanctuary unviolated, and that, through a series of indefinite generations, would the magnitude ever grow, and the luster ever brighten, of that household god, which he had erected for his own senseless adoration, and bequeathed as an object of as senseless adoration to his family. We have the authority of that word which has been pronounced a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart, that it cannot have two masters, that it cannot have two masters, or that there is not room in it for two great and ascendant affections. The engrossing power of one such affection is expressly affirmed of the love for mammon, or the love for money thus named and characterized as an idol. Or, in other words, if the love of money be in the heart, the love of God is not there. If a man be trusting in uncertain riches, he is not trusting in the living God, who giveth us all things richly to enjoy. If his heart be set upon covetousness, it is set upon an object of idolatry. the true divinity is moved away from his place. And, worse than atheism, which would only leave it empty, has the love of wealth raised another divinity upon his throne. So that covetousness offers a more daring and positive aggression on the right and territory of the Godhead than even infidelity. The latter would only desolate the sanctuary of heaven. The former would set up an abomination in the midst of it. It not only strips God of love and of confidence, which are his prerogatives, but it transfers them to another. And little does the man who is proud in honor, but, at the same time, proud and peering in ambition, little does he think that though acquitted in the eye of all his fellows, there still remains an atrocity of a deeper character than even that of atheism, with which he is chargeable. Let him just take an account of his mind, amid the labors of his merchandise, and he will find that the living God has no ascendancy there. But that wealth, just as much as if personified into life, and agency, and power, wields over him all the ascendancy of God. Where this treasure is, his heart is also. And linking as he does his main hope with its increase, and his main fear with its fluctuations and its failures, he has as effectually dethroned the Supreme from his heart, and deified an usurper in his room, as if fortune had been embodied into a goddess, and he were in the habit of repairing with a crowd of other worshippers to her temple. She, in fact, is the dispenser of that which he chiefly prizes in existence. A smile from her is worth all the promises of the eternal, and her threatening frown more dreadful to the imagination than all his terrors. And the disease is as near to universal as it is virulent. Wealth is the goddess whom all the world worshipeth. There is many a city in our empire, of which with an eye of apostolical discernment it may be seen that it is almost wholly given over to idolatry. If a man look no higher than to his money for his enjoyments, then money is his God. It is the God of his dependence, and the God upon whom his heart is stayed. Or if, apart from other enjoyments, it by some magical power of its own has gotten the ascendancy, then still it is followed after as the supreme good, and there is an actual supplanting of the living God. He is robbed of the gratitude that we owe him for our daily sustenance, for instead of receiving it as if it came direct out of his hand, we receive it as if it came from the hand of a secondary agent, to whom we ascribe all the stability and independence of God. This wealth, in fact, obscures to us the character of God as the real, though unseen, author of our various blessings. And as if by a material intervention, does it hide from the perception of nature the hand which feeds and clothes and maintains us in life and in all the comforts and necessaries of life. It just has the effect of thickening still more that impalpable veil which lies between God and the eye of the senses. We lose all discernment of him as the giver of our comforts, and coming, as they appear to do, from that wealth which our fancies have raised into a living personification, does this idol stand before us, not as a deputy, but as a substitute for that being, with whom it is that we really have to do. All this goes both to widen and to fortify that disruption which has taken place between God and the world. It adds the power of one great master idol to the seducing influence of all the lesser idolatries. When the liking and the confidence of men are towards money, there is no direct intercourse, either by the one or the other, of these affections towards God. And in proportion as he sends forth his desires, and rests his security on the former, in that very proportion does he renounce God as his hope, and God as his dependence. And to advert, for one moment, to the misery of this affection, as well as to its sinfulness. He, over whom it reigns, feels a worthlessness in his present wealth, after it is gotten. And when to this we add the restlessness of a yet unsated appetite, lording it over all his convictions, and panting for more, when, to the dullness of his actual satisfaction in all the riches that he has, we add his still unquenched, and indeed unquenchable desire for the riches that he has not, when we reflect that as, in the pursuit of wealth, he widens the circle of his operation, so he lengthens out the line of his open and hazardous exposure, and multiplies, along the extent of it, those vulnerable points from which another and another dart of anxiety may enter into his heart. When he feels himself as if floating on an ocean of contingency, on which perhaps he is only borne up by the breath of a credit that is fictitious, and which, liable to burst every moment, may leave him to sink under the weight of his overladen speculation. When, suspended on the doubtful result of his bold and uncertain adventure, he dreads the tidings of disaster in every arrival, and lives in a continual agony of feeling, kept up by the crowd and turmoil of his manifold distractions, and so overspreading the whole compass of his thoughts, as to leave not one narrow space for the thought of eternity. Will any beholder just look to the mind of this unhappy man, thus tossed and bewildered, and thrown into a general unceasing frenzy, made out of many fears and many agitations, and not say that the bird of the air which sends forth its unreflecting song and lives on the fortuitous bounty of providence is not higher in the scale of enjoyment than he? And how much more, then, the quiet Christian beside him, who in possession of food and raiment, has that godliness with contentment, which is great gain, who, with the peace of heaven in his heart, and the glories of heaven in his eye, has found out the true philosophy of existence, has sought a portion where alone a portion can be found, and in bidding away from his mind the love of money, has bidden away all the cross and all the carefulness along with it. Death will soon break up every swelling enterprise of ambition, and put upon it a most cruel and degrading mockery. And it is, indeed, an affecting sight, to behold the workings of this world's infatuation, among so many of our fellow mortals nearing every day to eternity, and yet instead of taking heed to that which is before them, mistaking their temporary vehicle for their abiding home, and spending all their time and all their thought upon its accommodations. It is all the doing of our great adversary, thus to invest the trifles of a day in such characters of greatness and durability, and it is indeed one of the most formidable of his wiles. And whatever may be the instrument of reclaiming men from this delusion, it certainly is not any argument either about the shortness of life or the certainty and awfulness of its approaching termination. Once this point, man is capable of a stout-hearted resistance, even to ocular demonstration. Nor do we know a more striking evidence of the derangement which must have passed upon the human faculties than to see how, in despite of arithmetic, how, in despite of manifold experience, how, in despite of all his gathering wrinkles and all his growing infirmities, how, in despite of the ever-lessening distance between him and his sepulchre, and of all the tokens of preparation for the onset of the last messenger, with which in the shape of weakness and breathlessness and dimness of eyes he is visited, will the feeble and asthmatic man still shake his silver locks in all the glee and transport of which he is capable when he hears of his gainful adventures and his new accumulations? Nor can we tell how near he must get to his grave, or how far on he must advance in the process of dying, ere gain cease to delight, and the idol of wealth cease to be dear to him. But when we see that the topic is trade and its profits, which lights up his faded eye with the glow of its chiefest ecstasy, we are as much satisfied that he leaves the world with all his treasure there, and all the desires of his heart there, as if, acting what is told of the miser's deathbed, he made his bills and his parchments of security the companions of his bosom, and the last movements of his life were a fearful, tenacious, determined grasp of what to him formed the all for which life was valuable.